changed minds in our personal lives can lead us, where it ends up going, right? So when you make a decision now in your life that's in the affirmative to do something or challenge yourself and push yourself, you have no idea where that decision will lead. And I think that when we do things that are, I can't think of a better word than for betterment in our lives, I believe it attracts other amazing things into our life as well and great learning opportunities. So, yeah, that's what this next book is.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Ray Zahab. Ray is an ultramarathon runner who runs in some of the most extreme conditions. He's run in most major deserts of the world, from the Sahara Desert to Death Valley, as well as in Arctic conditions. He does his running as a way to inspire others. He created an organization called Impossible to Possible to share his adventures with classrooms around the world, hopefully to inspire young people. And then he invites the young people to set their own goals in other ways to take their own adventures. He's the author of two books as well. Enjoyed my conversation. Hope you enjoy joining in. Here is my conversation with Ray Zahab. Well, Ray, thank you a lot for being here and having this conversation. And welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Eric.
Yeah. You have done a lot of impressive things that, you know, a lot of us just, you know, who are runners kind of dream about being able to do. But I would like to find out kind of what was the thing that was going through your mind. I mean, you probably started this a little bit later in life. What was it about your life that you went, I decided that I need to take on some big challenges?
Well, you know, it's a great question. To this point, I mean, it's funny where I am in my career now, and, you know, I rarely look back and you know, reminisce about the various expeditions I've done or whatever, but quite literally, I mean, I'm at about 13,000, 14,000 miles covered on foot, you know, most of the large deserts on the planet I've crossed, most of them in summertime. You know, I've done multiple unsupported Arctic expeditions, unsupported expeditions to Siberia, unsupported expeditions to the South Pole, you know, and all these sort of, so the different sort of variations, you know, from hottest to coldest places on Earth. And really, it all started for me a little bit later than most people would think. I'm 53. I didn't start doing any of this until I was 30, really. And so, you know, prior to that, I was, you know, smoking a pack a day. I wasn't the healthiest guy, sometimes two packs a day, depending on how many drinks were going down. But I wasn't out doing these things per se. And I think that more, it wasn't like I seeked out adventure. It was more like I was trying to find a way to become more fulfilled in my life and be happy. So in the late 90s, when I decided I needed to change my life, but I just was no longer satisfied with where my life was going, I didn't even know where to begin, dude, because I barely got out of school. I just wasn't sure what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And my younger brother was big into these adventure races, and it was like, he was a climber and an Ironman triathlete. And he was doing all these amazing things that I found very inspiring at that time. And I thought, wow, you know, like, he's in such great shape and he feels so good and loves the stuff that he does. He's very passionate. So maybe if I did the things he did, I would become very passionate, you know, about life. And you have to remember, this is all pre-social media. So you weren't exposed on a day-to-day basis to things that you could sort of strive for, reach for, dream about, or whatever. And so that was the nearest thing to me. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to try this stuff. And it, you know, I don't want to say I was instantly hooked. It would take me 3 years to quit smoking. It's arguably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. But when I did flip the switch and I changed my life, everything in my life changed 180 degrees. So beyond the physical aspect of becoming really in good shape and doing all these things, there was this this strange sort of almost cosmic change in my life, where when you start living your life in a certain direction and in a more positive sort of way, other things begin to happen in your life, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went from, I bounced around from, did a ton of ice climbing with my brother. It was a sport that we loved to do in winter, and got riding mountain bikes, and very quickly became good on my mountain bike and started racing mountain bikes, and was racing mountain bikes at the, you know, cross country and 24-hour solos and stage racing and mm-hmm, all these sorts mm-hmm. of things. And became very passionate about that. And then one step led to another. And then I read an article about ultra running in 2003, after having done a ton of adventure races and stuff, but I would be on foot, but not really running, you know, purely running.
Mm-hmm.
And I read an article about a race in the Yukon. And it was a 100-miler. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe these people do this kind of stuff. So I wanted to know, even though I wasn't much of a runner and I'd never done a running race of any kind, I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and do this and see what happens. And I ended up not only finishing it, to my absolute shock, but I won the race.
Wow.
And I knew in that moment that I had found something in a very short period of time. From quitting smoking to crossing the finish line in the Yukon was about 4 years. And I realized that I'd found something that I loved. And I went on from there for the next few years, racing in ultras all over the world, trying to figure out how I was able to overcome negative thoughts and doubts and fear and all that, like I did in the Yukon. I had no idea how I did it. And obviously I was physically in good shape from all the other stuff mm-hmm. I was doing, but to go out and do something like that, you know what it's like when you're in an ultra, at the end of the ultra, you feel really good sometimes. Mm-hmm. You can feel really good. And I just, like, I had no pain in my leg. I had pain in my leg at the halfway point, but I had no pain at the end.
Right.
When I crossed the finish line. Like, how did that happen? And so I started doing these races all over the world, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and met a couple of guys while I was out there in one of these races, and we decided that we were going to run across the entire Sahara Desert. And that 4,500-mile run across the Sahara, which was subsequently made into the movie Running the Sahara by Matt Damon, that was the beginning of my expeditions, if you will, career. And that was in 2006 through 2007. And ever since then, that's what I've been doing, expeditions.
Well, I remember in 2006 seeing news reports. I think it was news reports about your run across the Sahara Desert. And there was just, I mean, again, it was kind of the very early days of social media. But it was, I can't remember where it was that I saw that you were doing it. I thought that was, at the time, I thought that was incredible. But yeah.
Yeah, it was at a time when doing things like that were really unusual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so things have changed, I mean, dramatically. The ultra running world is just, it's exploded. It's a completely different thing. But this is more than a run, you know, because obviously with the documentary film that was made and everything else, I mean, it became a way for us to not only learn about ourselves in doing something like running an average of 40 miles a day, every day for 111 days in a very difficult environment, but also we learned as we ran across the six countries of Northern Africa that span the Sahara, we learned about culture and economics and agriculture and water crisis and everything else. And the film became a platform for fundraising for water projects in North Africa. So it was multifaceted. And when I finished that expedition, I knew that I wanted to do something. Because again, I was a guy who barely got out of high school. I was like thinking, wow, you know, I never cared about learning when I was in school, but I was fascinated about learning when I was in the Sahara because I'm on an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context of an adventure, we can learn many subjects. And so I thought, what an opportunity this is to marry expeditions and adventure with education for young people. And so after the Sahara, every one of my expeditions, there's been, I don't know, 30 expeditions have been connected to classrooms.
Okay.
Satellite. Or I also started a foundation called Impossible to Possible.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2008, we've been going. And we take young people that we select from around the world that apply to go on an expedition, and we take them on their own expedition, which is learning-based. And we've done, I don't know, 15 of these things all over the world, to the remotest parts of the world, and everything's 100% free. And so, you know, it was an idea that came from the Sahara. But, you know, as I said before, each decision that we make can not only transform our lives, but transform the way we think, and then transform our path where we go.
Yeah, and you said that you started doing the initially remote, so it was like a satellite, so that you, I'm guessing from what you said, well, my interpretation was that while you were on your adventure, the classroom was following along with you, and you got to interact with them as you were out there.
Yeah, that's improved. That technology continues to improve. But yes, during the Sahara expedition, we had a live website. And so that was mostly, like, I had no idea that schools were tuning in. It was after the expedition that I was like, oh, wow, schools are, like, totally stoked about this. But in subsequent expeditions, with my own expeditions, that's exactly right. If it's a really big expedition, like across the Namib Desert, which was 1,850 kilometers, did it in the middle of summer in 2018. So we built a live website. We had a tracker, page, a map, so schools could see where we were. We uploaded bits of content about this amazing desert that's filled with wildlife, some of it kind of dangerous, and schools got to learn about this incredibly complex ecosystem, which is Namibia. On the youth expeditions with Impossible to Possible, we'll take youth between the ages of 16 and 21, and they'll go into remote parts of the world like the Sahara Desert or the Amazon jungle or the Arctic, and they do their own expedition, and it's combined with a relevant educational program. It's connected back through a live website to school that are following along and participating.
Okay, so the students who are participating are then interacting with other students as well.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So I do. So basically, if you look at it, it's two different buckets. One bucket is my own expeditions, which are, you know, the riskier endeavors and all that jazz, and I connect with students personally, but it's not as frequent. On an Impossible to Possible youth expedition, every single day during the expedition, there's, you know, we might have tens of thousands engaging with us through the live website, whether answering questions or doing video chats or whatever. Our youth ambassadors are peer-to-peer teaching.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great way to, that's great for both sides, because kids will be able to, you know, see people they can identify with who are their age, and the kids who are presenting, you know, you learn your lessons better if you teach them. So,
absolutely.
Kind of a two-part question. What has been, I mean, what is kind of the, in a general sense, what are kids picking up from the participation from the remote learning? What has been your feedback of impact and the things that have been meaningful to the kids?
Well, I mean, look, it can range. I've been on youth expeditions. We've been doing this for many years, of course, and I've been on youth expeditions where, because I, of course, don't select the kids that go. We have a committee that does that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been on youth expeditions where I didn't really know the kids before the expedition. And we'll be on an expedition, I'll say, oh, so how'd you hear about us? And they'll say, well, you know, 5 years ago, I was in, middle school, and you guys were doing a youth expedition, and we were following, and I was so inspired. Someday I knew I would apply to try and go, and here they are on a youth expedition now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one impact, for example. But the other is that we take on subjects that aren't necessarily, you know, we have some easier ones, and we have some really difficult ones. We did access to healthcare when we took a group of youth to Rajasthan in 2012, I think that was, and they learned about the disparity of healthcare between the wealthiest people in India and the people that were the most impoverished. And so, you know, that quality of healthcare, you know, spans, you know, everything from zero access to a doctor to five-star healthcare. So, you know, it's a debate. It's a heavy debate. And so, you know, that would be a subject, for example, that schools would take on. So what's been the feedback? generally very positive. Everything we're doing is 100% free, and we're all volunteers. So right from the start, there's very little that's high quality that's available for schools these days. It's free anyhow. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to create an experience for the students that are following along with as involved with them as possible while removing the burden of cost to the schools.
Okay. Okay. So, and I imagine the kids, what are some of the things the kids learn about themselves? I mean, have you had any feedback from kids who've that they've made a significant difference in taking on
you
this challenge?
That have been on?
That have been on that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have a lot of them are alumni, and they work and volunteer within the foundation now whenever we are. I mean, we were in a standstill because of the pandemic for like 3-4 years. We couldn't do anything. Now we're getting going again. We have a youth expedition in June. So these kids will be helping us in development of curriculum, logistics, even guiding. I'm about to head out on an expedition in 2 weeks from now with one of my former youth ambassadors. She's going to be my expedition teammate full on a very difficult Arctic expedition.
Wow.
So, I mean, that also spans the range of going on an expedition with me someday to volunteering with an Impossible Possible to maybe making career decisions that are based on some of the subjects that they've learned about while on expedition.
Yeah, and there's something, I mean, you talked about the pushing yourself, and there's something about it that you said that there was more than just a physical challenge, but you said that the physical challenge actually led you to mindset shifts that seemed to kind of come just on their own. But I had a question for you. You said that you didn't know how you did the mindset work in your first 100-miler. Did you figure out, did you go back and analyze and kind of figure out what you did to be able to keep going?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is that, well, you know, in the case of that very first race, you know, it's the old ignorance is bliss, right?
You're
just kind of hammering through. Yeah. But you know what? In reality, what I've come to learn is that human beings underestimate themselves physically, mentally, and emotionally. And we're all capable of doing extraordinary things relative to our own lives. You know, the burden of social media is both positive and negative. Like in one aspect, the positive part is you can have a friend in, let's say, in Asia that you may never meet. But now you can communicate with that person, and they're your friends through social media, and you can learn about that part of the world. There's tons of positives, obviously. But the negative side of it is that there's these unrealistic expectations that are floated out there that some people feel they need to live up to instead of, in their own life, looking at the set of goals that they personally have and setting up those guardrails to create the things that they need to create in their own lives.
Right.
So every one of our lives is relative, unique, and no less valuable than the other. But I think we spend a lot of time looking out, seeing other people doing absolutely extraordinary things, and saying, well, that'll never happen for me, so what's the point in trying?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we have the capacity, every one of us, to do something amazing in our lives. And I think that that's really critical, you know? And that's been a mind shift for me during this career of doing very difficult expeditions, because I've had expeditions go really well, and I've had them not go well, where, you know, I'm unable to complete. But at the end of the day, it's making the decision and the willingness to take a risk, to stick your neck out there and try to do something that perhaps has never been done before, or that you've never done before in your life that you're doing for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's getting started. It's committing to something that I think is so critical nowadays.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to jump back. You said you were about 30 years old when this all started for you. There are a lot of, and that is a time when a lot of people come to, the things that they'd been, going through school, career, and everything, that's a point in life where things begin to kind of close in, and some people begin to start to feel trapped. Between 30 and 40 is kind of they can feel that they're getting into this rut, and they want to do something different, but they're afraid. So what were the challenges that you faced to actually make that step? Because there are a lot of people that I talk to who my brother-in-law was an example. He really wanted to be a ski instructor and an artist, but his parents wanted him to be a lawyer. And, you know, he got to about 40 and he's like, you know, I really don't like this. But he never changed. You know, he's still a lawyer.
Well, you know what? I mean, again, because every path is unique and every path is equally relevant to the other. But we're all living different lives, right? And I think it's finding within your own life the things that you can do and the goals that you can set for yourself. But I mean, it's, you know what? When we take chances in life, one of the biggest fears, like I had early on, was what would people think of me if I failed? Mm-hmm. Or what, you know, what's the point in trying? Because I know I'm going to fail anyhow, right? There was that negative mindset.
Right.
Instead, now I don't give a damn what anyone thinks. I mean, you know, as long as you're not offending someone with whatever your goal is or whatever, hurting someone, you're doing it for you, you do it. And if it doesn't work out, well, what the hell? You tried, mm-hmm. right? And I think that there's a lot in that, you know, that one can unpack, because at the end of the day, if you don't even try, what's the point even thinking about it? Like, you've got to, every now and then we have to take risks in life. And obviously measured risk and calculated risk is obviously the best kind of risk to take. But, you know, you've got to be willing to fail now and then. And I have a buddy, he also does podcasts, and, you know, he's a teacher, and it was really great. We were having a conversation one day, and we were talking about failure and failing and what does it mean. He says, you know, I never looked at it as a fail. I look at it as the first attempt in learning. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant, right? And so when you look at things from that perspective, you flip things around. Instead of looking at the glass half empty, you look at the glass half full or even overflowing. Mm-hmm. So you make decisions. You get better at making decisions. You get better at taking risks. And in doing that, you become comfortable with setbacks because you learn from those setbacks, and it helps you to get stronger for the next thing that you do. But if you don't even put your foot out there in the first place and take the first step, time's a waste, you know? And really, you've only got one kick at the can. Mm-hmm. You know, so you got to make the absolute most out of your life. And you know, sometimes we're throwing surprising circumstances or curveballs. Like just recently, in the last few months, I was diagnosed with a rare form of the blood cancer lymphoma. And I knew that it was going to mean, you know, getting into 6 months of chemotherapy. You know, I'm halfway through chemotherapy, mm-hmm. but I've had to adapt my life to the situation, but it hasn't stopped me. And I mean, listen, let me tell you something. I feel like shit when I take those chemo drugs. Like, they make me feel horrible mm-hmm. for days, but I come out of it, and then I start moving again. And I'm doing projects in this time period. I'm pushing what I feel are my personal limits in the best way that I can during this time period until this whole thing wraps up. So, you know, it's a willingness to, instead of, and I guess the point of me bringing that whole thing up is I had a choice. I could have just said, bring it. I'm just going to stay at home. I'm going to do nothing. I'm just going to kind of lay around. But and there's nothing wrong with that decision. If that's what someone wants to do, mm-hmm. if that's what they need to do, because everybody's circumstances are different, then that's what you do. But for me, I didn't want to do that. And I was going to continue to take those chances and get out there. And, you know, with, of course, the blessing of my doctors. But, you know, get out there and do things still for me that were challenging for me and, you know, motivating me to get healthier faster.
Yes. And that's you talk about your thoughts around that, your perspective on it, of saying this is just a setback. It's something that I'm going to, you know, I have to deal with, but I'm going to keep pushing. You know, I'm going to keep going forward. This is something that is just, you know, it's like something that goes wrong in one of your expeditions. You know, you have setbacks and things.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I'm very fortunate that I don't have that. My father died of cancer. It was a very aggressive type of cancer that he had. So I'm glad I don't have that, mm-hmm. you know? But at the same time, in my own life, again, going back to this, it's relative to our own lives, I'm going through something that's very difficult in my life right now. But I have chosen to approach it and see it in a different way, in a different light, you know? And whether I want to see it I'm not saying a positive light, but whether I want to try and live my life to the fullest that I can right now, or I don't, and I decide to just stay at home, either way, I still got this disease. Like, right. It's not going away either way. So may as well, what the hell, give it everything I got, you know?
Right, right. And that's the decision that you made, and that's, you know, everybody makes decisions. And I've seen, you know, had a family member who made the decision that their life was over. And that happened. I mean, that it was very evident that it was the mindset that was kind of aiding that the progression of the disease. So
yeah.
Now, you've written a couple of books as well. What led you to do that?
Well, you know what, it's been a long time, you know, since the last book, and I'm currently working on my next book. The reasons I was doing the other books were different than they are now.
Okay.
The book I'm writing now, obviously it's stories from these expeditions, and it's what you'd expect it to be. But I'm writing it for my daughters, you know, that are 14 and 11, and they're great athletes in their own right now. They're doing their own things. They have their own passions and sports that they do that my wife and I don't necessarily do. So, you know, but I want to write this book for them. The previous books, I wanted to write them to hopefully show people. The first book was written for adults. The second book was written for young people. To show them that, and it was early career stuff. So both books ended before the Running the Sahara expedition. So
oh, okay. Imagine, okay, wow. So it was very early.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. It's like, it's crazy. So the point is that I wanted those books to change people's mindsets on what was potentially possible in their own lives. This next book, I want to obviously continue that way of thinking, but also where our changed minds and our personal lives can lead us, where it ends up going, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you make a decision now in your life that's in the affirmative to do something or challenge yourself and push yourself, you have no idea where that decision will lead. And I think that when we do things that are, I can't think of a better word than for betterment in our lives, I believe it attracts other amazing things into our life as well,
mm-hmm.
and great learning opportunities. So, yeah, that's what this next book is.
I like that. And then it also, you know, that's something that a lot of people oftentimes don't do. I mean, they don't leave stories behind, except, you know, just, you know, in memory, a few, but having written down your thoughts rather than just living in the memories of, you know, what your family or friends would remember that, you know, that you had told or done. So yeah, writing it in your own voice is a good thing to do.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So you tell what your next expedition is in the Arctic coming up in the summer. Is that what I heard you say?
No, I'm leaving in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks?
In January.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll be up there in January, crossing a very remote valley on Baffin Island. And, you know, it's the coldest time of year in one of the coldest places mm-hmm. on Earth. It's winter in the northern hemisphere, so it's very cold, obviously. So, but I'm excited. I'm collecting weather data. I collected weather data on a west-to-east transect of Death Valley, which is the hottest place on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I crossed Death Valley north to south in 2011, but now I crossed it west to east at its widest point this past summer. And during that crossing, we gathered weather data along the entire transect. And so we'll take that weather data and we'll compare it to the coldest place, one of the coldest places on Earth that we mm-hmm. get this winter. And we'll be using it in a future Impossible youth expedition for the curriculum.
Okay, cool. Well, and this, if I remember it, this summer in Death Valley was one of the hotter ones, if I remember right.
It was pretty hot.
Yeah.
Pretty hot, I gotta say. I've done multiple projects in Death Valley, and I've always seemed to be there in July or August, mm-hmm. and it's hot. So, yeah,
I follow the Badwater 135, which is in July, runs from Death Valley to, is it Mount Whitney? If I remember right, is the name of the mountain?
Yeah, it goes to the Whitney Portal. It exits Death Valley. Yeah. It exits Death Valley, and then it goes to Lone Pine, and then it goes up the Whitney Portal on the road.
Yeah, on the road, yeah.
So all of my projects in Death Valley have been off-road.
Yeah,
so
right, right.
And in sort of different areas. But I've crossed, Badwater, it's the road, and I have so many friends that have participated. It's a great race.
Yeah, yeah. But and so I kind of follow that, and so you know, I remember them saying that this was a fairly hot year this year. So
yeah.
Well, that's great. Ray, tell my listeners, if people wanted to connect with you and get a hold of you, how's the best way to catch base with you?
Yeah, the best way, so yeah, you know what, everybody's using Instagram these days, so I'll say that. I mean, go to Instagram if that's where your listeners are, and I'm on there, they'll find me. And I have a website. There's links to all that stuff in my Instagram, whatever, bio thing, mm-hmm. as well. You know, if people are interested, we have a guiding company called Capic One, and we just finished wrapping up a trip in the Atacama Desert in Chile. We have an amazing group of runners there that came with us. It was a lot of fun. So we do guided expeditions as well for adults.
Okay.
And if anybody's interested, they can get in touch with me. They'll find those links as well on my Instagram bio.
Well, great, great. I appreciate it. Before I let you go, I have what I call the bridge questions.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three, ere the other side he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper, I'm not afraid.
What's your must-have piece of gear when you're out?
Must-have piece of gear. You know what? It's changed over the years. Believe it or not, I would say now it's my iPhone. Because I use it with, you know, third-party apps and whatnot to navigate. It's a great backup navigation or primary navigation tool. It's my camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's linked to my sat phone, so I make my calls back to my family. It's linked to satellite, so satellite receivers so that I can upload content for school. It's kind of central, you know, to me doing my expedition, wherever it is, whether it's hot places or cold places. So mm-hmm. it's like, it's my way, it's my portal, my tool to connect, to bring young people and immerse them on expeditions, and then have those expeditions brought back into the classroom. I do it all with that phone.
That's cool. That's cool. I've heard other people who said the iPhone is a very great piece of gear to have when you're out. So
yeah.
Second question is, what is the strangest thing that you've seen when you've been out on your adventures? That may be a hard one to pick for you.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I've seen a lot of strange stuff over the years, like a lot of crazy, crazy stuff. You know, I've crossed just deserts alone, you know, the Sahara Desert, the Atacama Desert, the Patagonian Desert, the Gobi Desert, the Namib Desert, you know, Antarctica is a desert. You know, so there's been a lot of time spent in some crazy places. But I think, you know what, I saw pictoglyphs in Chile when I crossed the Atacama Desert in 2011. And all kinds of crazy stuff depicted in those petroglyphs or pictoglyphs. And so I thought that was really kind of neat. You know, seeing all these crazy animals and stuff depicted and, you know, stuff like that. You know, like I love that stuff that's mysterious, you know, and when I'm out there seeing all that, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder what were they thinking? What was the, you know, what was their life like? Yeah, that's good. So the third question is, what is a word or phrase that sums up your philosophy of life?
Well, you know, I said this many, many, many years ago, actually, after we crossed the Sahara Desert, and yeah, more or less doesn't change much over the years, but that the most difficult challenges that we take on are 90% mental, and the other 10% is all in our heads. And what I mean by that mm-hmm. is, when we do these difficult things, we accept that there's going to be a physical component to it. I mean, that's just, you're a 100-mile runner, guys. So you're going to go run 100 miles. It's going to be friggin' hard to run 100 miles. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's not like, oh, well, you know, my feet feel fantastic today. There always is going to be some pain involved.
Mm-hmm.
So with the acceptance of that comes the mental, and it's the mental that gets you through. So with all the things that we do in life, I mean, it's the mental challenge that ends up being most difficult.
That's true. That's a great way to end. Thank you a lot, Ray. Appreciate you,
Eric,
being here.
Well, had
a great,
you know,
conversation.
Happy New Year to you.
Yes, happy
yeah,
New Year
happy
to you too as well.
To you and your family, and we'll chat again soon in the future.
Thank you a lot. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there, more information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. My online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do not know somebody who might like it, take just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. You need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.